Welcome to the 13th annual Tour for Thai Kids. At the beginning and the end of the seasons, it's always good to reflect on how amazing we've been able to keep finding more subjects to do. I'm Mark Cooper, and I'll be moderating today's session. As always, we thank the Harry H. Barron Trust and Rabbi Zev Barron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Thai Kids. And I could just said we are celebrating our bar mitzvah. Was last year the bat mitzvah? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So through the past 12 seasons, we've brought Torah perspective on business and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. And what do we do, about 7 sessions a year?
Oh, we do about 10 usually.
10?
9 or 10.
So we have done well over 100 sessions. There will not be a class in October, of course, with all the holidays. Our next class will be Wednesday the 2nd. We just completed our first, 15 minutes ago, our first 24-hour All or Nothing campaign. The campaign raised over $209,190. Yay! Shows you the power of the internet. We might have to do another. We've done internet sessions. Maybe it's time to do another, right? So it's amazing. They work. We had a number of individuals who pledged matching money, and then we went live online, right? And had, I don't know how many people donated, but quite a few.
Well over 200.
Well over 200 people. So it works. If you have missed past classes, you can find them at the Kollel's website, www.denverkollel.org. You can actually find a lot of other programming, other classes, Taste of Torah every week, lots of good programming and materials, and of course announcements to other classes. We'd also like to acknowledge we have a member from our armed forces here today. You recently moved here?
About 2.5 months ago.
From where?
Shreveport, Louisiana.
Really? And Air Force, I think I saw there. What's your name?
Chaim Shmuel Stitzer.
Well, welcome, Chaim, and hope you are settling well here. We're going to ask you to come and do this in a couple months. Is that all right? Or,
yeah. Speak to my secretary.
Okay. So today I'd like to present Avi Mailer, and hopefully I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, land manager for KV Kaufman Company, and of course Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, senior educator for Denver Community Kollel. Today we're going to do mineral rights and split, what we call a split estate, where one can own the surface, and I'm actually a land owner, investor, developer myself, and we do learn that even if we own the land, we may not own what's under it or sometimes even over it. So that's what we're going to talk today about, mineral and surface rights. I personally have had some experience where we've had to negotiate surface use agreements with oil and gas companies. It's always very interesting. So with that, Avi will talk a little bit about what he does and has his questions and issues. We have Torah perspective, as always, and then at the end we will open it up for discussion, questions. We're ending at 1 or 1:15 today? 1:15 today. So here we go.
Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you to the Kollel for asking me to present. And thank you to my father for joining us today. As Mark alluded to, I work for KP Kaufman Company. I work in their land department. Where, as Mark mentioned, we drill and produce oil and gas wells mainly in the state of Colorado. And in my capacity in the land department, it's my job to, as I will discuss a little bit further, is to acquire the lands and the mineral rights to drill for oil and gas, and then once it's drilled and the wells are there, maintain surface owner relationships. We deal with the state to get permits to drill on, and have dealt a lot with, not Mark personally, but probably a lot of Mark's colleagues and competitors in terms of landowners and real estate developers. So I just give a brief overview of this topic that we're discussing, the issues of mineral and surface rights, and then turn it over to Rabbi Fleischer for the Torah halachic discussions. So just sort of a little bit of a historical background is that most countries that have, including those with common law, the state or the crown really owns all the oil and gas minerals, the subsurface mineral rights. The U.S., the United States, is unique in that there's an extensive amount of private ownership of these mineral rights. And frankly, the reason why it came about was actually an accident on the government's from their perspective, is that when they were giving out or giving their patents to the lands in the 19th and early 20th century, their intention was to reserve all the land where they thought there was an extensive amount of valuable deposits of oil and gas minerals, and they would divest of the other ones for agricultural purposes where they thought it wasn't as lucrative and there wasn't that much of a deposit of oil and gas rights. They were mistaken in that regard, while there is a lot of federal-owned lands, there is now a lot of private ownership throughout the United States. And basically is that the main types of ownerships in terms of mineral and gas is that they're either, like I mentioned, there's federal, there's private owners, and then there's also state-owned lands that they are entitled to the minerals. And historically, when the government was giving out the lands, you would have one surface owner, and when they gave out the land, he would own the surface and the mineral rights below that. However, over time, the minerals and the surface became severed, where you would have two separate owners, one on the surface and one on the minerals. And as Mark mentioned, that's what we call a split estate.
When did that come to be? In other words, at some point, I assume maybe in the 18th century, people didn't realize there were two types of wealth around.
Right.
At what point in the United States did that definition and that realization come about?
So it really came about, the real first oil production wasn't until the late 19th century. Right, and that's really when it started, but I think it's really evolved over time. I mean, we continue to find new areas where it becomes economic to produce oil and gas, but really it wasn't until like the late 19th and early 20th century when all this started.
So when I bought my house, and I bought that piece of property, do I own what's under it, or I only own that surface?
The assumption is yes. I'll get to that towards the end, but the assumption is yes.
I can add, too. So part of the history, especially in the western United States...
The
old Homestead Act. So when you had the eastern half of the United States, you had a lot of water, and the Homestead Act partially had to do with if you had water contiguous to X number of acres, you could take... the government would give it to you. But here in the west, there were millions of acres that were... sitting there in government ownership to entice the railways to build railroads and more or less conquer the West. The government gave a lot of acres to the railway companies. In fact, when we buy property and we look at the title, sometimes some of these companies, even though it's owned by ConocoPhillips or Exxon, the name of the company could be like Burlington Northern Mineral Company. So for whatever reason, when these railways sold all this free land they got, especially in urban areas like Denver or Phoenix or whatever, they chose to keep the mineral rights underneath. And that's when things started severing. And I think that was what probably the 1860s, 1880s, if I remember right.
I think
right.
It was Ulysses S. Grant, who he was the Literally. President at the time, yeah. And he gave, what he did is that, mm-hmm. I mean, this might be a little too detailed, but the way that the oil and gas fields are divided up is by township and range and sections. Each section is 640 acres, and what Grant, the President Grant at the time did is he gave every other section to the railroad. And to this day, like Mark said, the railroad owns the minerals, although there were a couple of, specifically in Colorado, there was a company called Anadarko that they actually bought all those minerals. So they happened to get the best of both worlds, is where they drill the wells and then they pay themselves the royalty. So that's it's a good setup for them. Just going back a little bit is that, so now once you have, the assumption is that until the mineral and the surface were severed, you would have one estate. And alluding to what Patty sort of brought up, the assumption in when it comes to purchasing property is that you buy, when a person buys a piece of property in Weld County in northern Colorado, they get all right title and interest. So if a person buys a surface, the assumption is that he is getting the surface and the minerals below, unless, of course, the minerals were severed prior to him buying it, or if, going back, let's say you had the original owner of it, when he sells the surface, he can reserve the minerals to himself. He can reserve a portion of the minerals. He can reserve different ways that the contracts are written up, but the assumption is that you get all right title and you get the surface, what's above, and also what's below, unless it's specified otherwise. So now when it comes to oil and gas operations, when you're dealing with these split estates, what I predominantly deal with is that you first have to determine who owns the minerals. From an oil and gas perspective, that's the most important. So what we do is we run a title search, which is basically we go back to the patent, to when the U.S. government had given it out, and you identify, and then you basically run the title all the way back from then to determine who the present-day owner is. And it can be a pretty cumbersome process. Generally, you have someone to do the initial stuff. Ultimately, you might get a division order title opinion, which is actually an attorney's opinion of who owns the minerals at that particular time. And then you go, after identifying that, you go and obtain an oil and gas lease from the current mineral owner or owners, which is often the case, and you then have the right to then you negotiate with them what their royalty payments are, and then you have the right to extract the minerals. But that's only one side of the equation, because now you, if in the ideal world from our perspective, you want to have the guy who owns the surface who also owns the minerals, because he's going to profit from the extraction of the minerals. The problem is when you have these split estates, the surface owner will not get the ultimate benefit from the value of the oil and gas minerals, but you need his surface in order to extract these minerals. And that's when the negotiations start. The general rule when it comes to, and this is the common law, that general rule is that the mineral estate is the dominant estate when it comes to the surface and the minerals. So technically, the surface owner can't prohibit you from coming on the land to extract the minerals. The theory being is that originally, whoever owned the original surface and minerals, when he severed that estate and he sold his surface, the theory is that he was only selling his surface as long as it wouldn't inhibit him and prohibit him from accessing and extracting the minerals, which is what was a value that had a certain value. So given that technically the mineral estate is the dominant estate, you have to then try to go and negotiate now with the surface owner to get access and to use his surface. This dominant is obviously subject to any limitations which were imposed by applicable case law or statutory laws or regulations that have been in place. For instance, I'm more familiar with Colorado. We have the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission, which is a state agency which regulates a lot of what rights oil and gas companies have vis-a-vis the surface owner. But the courts have definitely struggled with this competing interest between the surface owner, maintaining the surface owner's rights to do whatever, whether it's farming it or developing it from a real estate perspective. They wanted to make it that it's compatible, that you know these competing rights both can sort of coexist in this type of setup. In the 1970s, this absolute dominance was modified to an extent where now mainly the surface owners and the mineral owners operate under what's called the accommodation doctrine, where that this accommodation doctrine tries to balance these competing interests. And the purpose of this accommodation doctrine is the way it sounds is that basically you try to accommodate each other's interests. And this is the rule in most of the states, for sure the most of the Rocky Mountain states where oil and gas is very prevalent. So once you have this, the most of the states now have also adopted the surface damage, surface use statutes to provide protection to the surface owners. So they are made whole, honoring the dominant mineral estate, but also making sure that the surface owners are not taken advantage of. As Mark alluded to, he's had the pleasure of negotiating with the oil companies, and I've had that same pleasure, is that you try to coexist, and because we know that according to law, both estates have rights, so you really try to do some good faith negotiations to compensate the surface owners and to make sure that what you are doing is consistent and at least protects their surface rights and to develop how they please. As I sort of alluded to beforehand, each state has their own governing agency that's to oversee the development of oil and gas and make it that they develop oil and gas in a safe and efficient, environmentally safe way. The major current issue, which is going on now and specifically in Colorado, which happens to be a major battleground state for these discussions, is we reference that there are these state agencies that help regulate, but there's also local agencies like towns and all that stuff. And I'm sure you've read about it in the paper that Colorado, as I said, is a battleground state for this, is that there's conflicting governing in terms of who has the rights, whether it's the state has the last say, or is the local towns they should have the last word. And normally, state law is preempts the local, but as you've probably read about in the papers, the local government have put up quite the fight. And even as recent as last week, there was an initiative that was trying to get onto the ballot, the November ballot, where the local governments were trying to make these certain setbacks. They were trying to have these setbacks, 2,500-foot setbacks from any structure, so you couldn't place an oil and gas well. And also, it's just as much as it was affecting the oil and gas company, it was impacting the real estate developers as well, as they weren't able to put any new homes 2,500 feet of an existing oil and gas well. So this was really driven by the local governments, and thankfully they did not get the requisite amount of signatures to make it a ballot initiative, and hopefully it is dropped at least for this year. But that was all sort of historical discussions. Nowadays, and I'll conclude with this, is that as the technology has developed for oil and gas development where they have now have the ability to extract minerals which they weren't able to get to historically, and now it's more economic and efficient for them to do so. What has really developed is that in order to decrease surface impact and surface footprint, now what they're going to is they make these centralized oil and gas pads, and they're able to then drill 25, 40 wells from that central pad, and they just have one centralized footprint, and now they, you know, drill horizontally and directionally, and that really has helped with the negotiations, because the surface owner knows that the oil and gas operations will be in one area, and then they will have the rest of their surface to continue to develop it as they please. I have, over the years, before the advent of this, we've had historical old oil and gas wells on these properties. Developers have wanted to come in and put a housing development. There are a number of ways that the ultimate picture looks is that sometimes the developers just buy the oil and gas wells and they get rid of them, or they build homes around them. They put their roundabouts around these oil and gas wells. So you get creative when it comes to these type of issues, but the new technology has helped in this regard. So really, that's sort of the synopsis of the historical background of the split estates. When you deal with the surface and the mineral rights, especially when they're severed, the assumption when you buy a piece of property is that you own the minerals unless it had been reserved prior to you buying it. That's what a title search would show you. But really, both industries try to work together to respect each other's rights and allow the surface development to take place while being able to extract oil and gas minerals.
Oh, sure. A couple questions before we go.
Just a quick one. So, if I'm sitting over oil, but I don't want to negotiate with you, or can you go somewhere else because you can go horizontally now and take my minerals out?
So, are you the mineral owner or the surface owner?
I'm the surface owner, but I also own
the minerals? So, yes, there are. So, because these. I didn't really touch on this, but the assumption is that they have these state regulations are when you drill a well, you form a unit, basically. And the assumption is that you drill a well and you drain a certain amount of acreage around you. So therefore, it used to be 40 acres, and it was 80 acres, and it was 160 acres, and now it's 640 acres, now it's 1,280 acres that they're... So, you have to, number one is, from an oil and gas perspective, you have to, even though this is all happening subsurface, you have to obtain oil and gas leases from all the mineral owners. So that could be, if he's a wealthy rancher and he has 1,280 acres, he'll be an even wealthier rancher once the oil and gas is drilled. But most of the time it's not that easy, and you have to obtain oil and gas leases from everyone. Your question is, let's say you don't want to have an oil and gas lease. So technically, you become part of the unit, but unless you object, this goes into the whole permitting process. The oil and gas company has to send out a notice, file for an application to create this oil and gas well unit, send out notice to all the oil and gas mineral owners. They then have the right to object to the unit if they want. If they don't have a good reason, they ultimately their acreage will be pooled, and there's rules how they'll ultimately get paid as well. But there are, from a surface perspective, if you own both the surface and the mineral rights, you do have the right, and it is somewhat common, especially if it's the owner is a developer, a real estate developer. They have what's called a non-development oil and gas lease, where you get the access to the minerals, but you cannot develop and use any of the surface, which is common nowadays, especially with the advent of horizontal and directional drilling.
And you didn't say anything about fracking. Is there a reason you didn't talk about that?
Fracking is a later process. It's another one of these newspaper words that everyone loves to hear about, but it's a later process, and that's what you do when you drill the well.
It is
part of the oil and gas development process, so it would all fall under the... To drill an oil and gas well, you have to frack the well.
Got it.
It just happens... Nowadays, everyone has made this into a word, that a curse word.
So when you got your chunk of land, you got oil and water. And two questions. Whoever owns the subsurface rise, is he over the water then, or is that a separate?
That also is. It can be severed as well. You don't necessarily own the water rights under your property if it was reserved beforehand. Similar to oil and gas, there is a market for leasing water rights as well. It's a pretty competitive and hot market as well, I'm sure.
So Mark can talk to this. You could technically have two or three plus owners underneath you. You could have a water right owner, you could have an oil and gas owner, if you have a coal seam, you might have somebody else owning the coal under you.
Also, it's pretty complicated.
Yes.
You can get, yeah.
And then you got the issue with what you talked about fracking. All the people are accusing the oil drillers of leaching chemicals into their groundwater.
Right. Definitely a hot topic. I know from an oil and from the operator's standpoint is that we do a lot to basically avoid that. There's a number of layers of cement that we cement off the aquifers so to prevent this particular issue.
All right. Thank you very much, Avi, for presenting. And thank you, Mark, for moderating today. Thank you all for coming. So... what I'd like to try to focus on is, Avi mentioned a lot of different pieces. Obviously, we don't have sufficient time, and I'll admit I don't have sufficient expertise to go into every last detail, but to try to get an overview of some of the issues from a Talmudic halachic standpoint that come up in Avi's discussion. The two main areas that I'm going to try to focus on are, as Avi mentioned, the rights when you sever the land and surface rights. Again, just basic observations of what the Talmud says about it, and you know, as Avi mentioned, it can get very complicated when you're talking about all the different mineral rights and water rights and oil and gas rights and so on. You would need a very competent and qualified halachic authority to hash out all the details and figure out every little piece. But we'll try to just get a basic idea of an overview of what the issues that a judge in a Bezdin, in a Jewish court of law, would be looking at, or at least some of them. And the second issue I would like to try to focus on is that last thing that came up, and that is the concern of potential damage to neighboring, to adjacent properties, to people in the area, and so on and so forth. I am not taking a position one way or the other. As Avi said, they take precautions, and I will leave any further discussion about that to the media and the various commissions and federal and state governmental bodies who deal with these things. So we start off with a passage, if you look at source number one, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that lays down a very basic rule, and that is one who sells an item to another that has other separate uses, he has not sold the additional uses unless he so specifies. Now, obviously, we're not talking about where I sell you a car, and the basic use of a car is to get from point A to point B, but perhaps you want to also use that car to sleep in. So you don't have to separately buy the rights to sleep in the car. We're talking about a situation where you have, let's just talk about our case, a piece of land, and you're buying a home, let's just say. And so the primary purpose of buying the land and the home is to live in the house. Live in the home, and you're not focusing in this purchase on the water rights, on the oil and gas rights, on the mineral rights. That's not the focus. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, lays down that one who sells that item, and there are other uses that are not being focused on in the negotiations, in the sale, so those are assumed by default to have not been sold. And we'll see more details about this as we move on. But that's the basic first step. Which brings us to source number two, which is a passage in the Talmud, in Tractate Bava Basra, which says that Rav Dimi of Nardah said, one who sells a house to his fellow, even if he wrote in the contract depth and height, he must write acquire from depths of the earth to the height of the sky. What's the reasoning for this? For the depth and the height is not acquired without specification. Depth and height serves to convey the space below and above, and from the depths of the earth to the height of the sky serves to convey the pit, cisterns, and excavations. Let me explain what this passage means. I just read it quickly. What the Talmud is telling us is as follows. If I buy a piece of land from you, I'm buying a house. So there are two other areas we have to deal with. One area is the air rights above, and the other is the land rights below. Do I have the rights to the land below the property, the home that I'm purchasing? There may also be additional construction or items on the land, such as a pit or a cistern, which is what the Talmud is talking about. This was a very common method for water storage back in the day, and anyone who studied Talmud knows that pits and cisterns make their appearance frequently in many different areas of Jewish law in terms of storage of water and in terms of protecting from damages and things like that. So let's just say that I'm purchasing a home from Avi and there's a water pit on the property. Is it assumed that I'm purchasing that water pit as well? And so the Talmud tells us that unless it's specified, not just that I'm acquiring the depths and the heights, meaning the land rights and the air rights, but you have to say more than that. You have to say the depths of the earth to the height of the sky. A little bit strange language over there, but the point is that the excess verbiage is coming to convey that there's more being transferred than just the home. You could just write specifically, I'm selling you the pit as well. But apparently this was common terminology used in documents, that if you were just to write depth and height, that indicates that I'm buying not just the home, but I'm buying the air rights above and the land rights below as well, but not a pre-existing structure. So if there's already a pit or a cistern or something similar on the property, that's already another step. And so you would need a separate expression in the contract, either to express outright or to indicate that that is part of the sale. Okay? And so the Talmud, again, is making clear to us that if I buy a home, it's not assumed that I'm buying everything with it. And I think that would be in contrast to what Avi mentioned in terms of common American law, that it's assumed unless otherwise already previously determined. All right? I should point out, and I should have mentioned this at the outset, that our discussion here is subject to what we call dina de malchus adina, the law of the land is law. Okay, so if you're coming to America and you bought a piece of land and you sold a piece of land, and then they strike oil, you can't come back and say the rabbi said that that I still have the oil rights because you didn't say depth and height. If the local law, the American law, says that it's assumed that you purchased that as well, that will override the Talmudic law in this case. So we're talking about in a situation where you don't have other laws in place already. What would the halacha, what would the Torah say about it? So off the bat, that is the basic idea, that unless specified, you don't acquire the additional land rights. Even if you acquire the land rights and the air rights, you haven't acquired pre-existing structures unless there's additional words to express that, to convey that idea. Okay? And so that's the basic law, which brings us to source number three, and I apologize, it's a bit lengthy. I'll try to get through the words here and to give over what's happening. So source number three is again a passage in the Code of Jewish Law, in the Shulchan Aruch. And it says, if he did not write depth and height at all, but rather sold the house without specifications, the buyer does not have in the airspace above nor below, not anything. And if the seller, now here's where life gets interesting, if the seller, who still retains the air and land rights, wants to build above the house in the airspace on supports. Okay, you can imagine this picture in your mind. You've got these stilts with another floor hovering above the house that he bought. He may do so, but he cannot build upon the walls that he sold. Those are my walls. So I purchased the house from Avi. Avi now comes and says, I'd like to build a house up in the air. And I say, that's a bit of a pie in the sky. He says, no, it's not. It says right here that I can build it. I'm going to build some pillars on the sides, and here's going to be my second-story house atop. As long as he's not taking away from my home, he's not placing his new floor on top of my house, he has the right to do so. Similarly, if he wants to dig from outside and go under the land of the house, and we'll get later about having the rights to come onto the property, but if he wants to access, as he mentioned, the horizontal digging, so you want to dig and go under to access those minerals, that oil that belongs to him, he still retained it, he may do so, so long as he does not cause damage with his digging to the homeowner. Okay, and some say that he cannot dig at all because he might, so that he not cause damage. In other words, the second opinion is expressing the concern that you may cause damage even if you don't realize it. And we'll try to expand on this idea a little bit later. So, but now, if that's the case, if he can't dig under my house, what does he gain by excluding the depth? He can't access it. So why was it excluded? If the buyer would go ahead and dig pits, ditches, or vaults, they belong to the seller. So let me just give a synopsis of what was just said over here. Yes, it's true that if I purchase the home and there is no specification that I'm buying the land rights, the air rights, the pre-existing structures, they are retained by the seller. They're retained by the seller, but the seller doesn't necessarily have easy access to that. He can't walk onto my property and start digging, but to the extent that he's not impinging on my purchase, on my home, be that by digging on the ground, he's not ruining my foundation, he's not going to ruin my water. Let's just say that I have a well on the property or whatever it may be, he's not going to impinge on my rights and what I own on the property. He's allowed to do that. Okay? To the extent that one opinion says that he can't dig under because you don't realize it, but there's a chance it'll cause damage. There's a chance it'll cause damage. Whenever you dig under someone's house, there's a good chance that you're going to cause some sort of damage, and therefore it is completely forbidden without getting explicit permission. Well, then the question becomes, as expressed, what did the seller gain by retaining those land rights? That if I go ahead, I, the homeowner, I purchased this house, I decided to dig a pit, or I decided to drill for oil and I struck oil, it's his oil. He owns the oil, even though I go digging for it, but he will own whatever I find, whatever I get underground, or whatever I get out of the airspace. The seller who retained those rights, he is the owner of whatever I managed to dig up underneath my house or on that property. So Dr. Naylor is referring to what's called a chazaka. There are different ways, according to Jewish law, to acquire real estate. And one of them is merely by what you call chazaka, which means basically doing an act, performing an act that shows you are the owner. The Talmud discusses different methods. Just as an example, putting up a fence around the property would be a way of showing ownership, and that's a way to acquire the land. I don't think it would make a difference in the absence of any expression that I am also acquiring the land rights. If the agreement was I'm buying this home, or even just, we'll talk about if you're buying a blank piece of land in a minute. This is about a home. If I'm buying the house, all I'm getting is the house. I'm not getting the rights underneath, and I'm not getting the airspace above. All I'm getting is the home, unless otherwise specified. It wouldn't matter if it was via document or via money or via an act of chazak, of showing ownership, unless specified otherwise when discussing the terms of the deal. If you didn't draw up a document, the burden of proof would be on the buyer, as what we call hamotzi mechaveri, and he's the one pulling out, extracting from the previous holder of the rights. So he would have to prove that was discussed verbally as part of the deal. It's not. It wouldn't give you a broader opportunity. Chazaka is merely a means of acquisition. It doesn't give you more power over the property because you use that form.
It makes you protest.
What? That's something else. Dr. Mayer, are you talking about the question of the previous owner doing something to assert his ownership?
Space
I'm sorry. I'm not clear on what.
Well,
Okay, we can talk after this. All right. We're talking about two different chazakas. Oh, you're talking about third paragraph of a Basra chazaka. Okay, we'll talk afterwards. Fine, two different terminologies. Sorry. Yes, okay, got it.
Huh? Didn't know about, let's say, they
right.
Didn't know about the law. That guy sitting there believed he owned everything.
Okay. Okay. So you're raising a separate issue. Yeah. You want to know that in Talmudic times, when oil wasn't an issue, is it assumed that he buys that or not? I would venture to say that he is not assumed to have sold it, because the point being made over here in the Talmud is, I am selling you exactly what it says in this document. I'm selling you a house. Anything that it doesn't say, I retain whether I know it exists or not. You know, to the extent that oil is in the land, I haven't sold you the rights to the land. Now, I may think that land is only worth it for digging a pit right now to hold water. But at the end of the day, I never sold you the rights to the oil. I would retain it.
Well, one thing seems missing, and maybe you just haven't brought it up, is what constitutes in simple quantitative terms above and below.
Okay, so I didn't get involved in those details. It would depend. We're going to see right now in a moment the case of a field, but there's a lot of talk about. Let's say I buy what's called a chutz or a courtyard, an area where you know, it's not meant for constructing a house, but for use adjacent to a home. So there, the halacha talks about how much airspace you are assumed to have. If I buy a lot upon which I'm going to build a home. Is discussed. How much height do you have? Is that a very specific? I think it says the height of the person, the average height of a person, plus a load on top of his head without having to bend down or something to that effect. You know, so again, it's codified, and you would do well in a document if you wanted to have 10-foot ceilings instead of 7-foot ceilings or 8-foot ceilings to specify that in the document.
We're assuming that it's slab on grade. We're assuming that it's yeah. there's no basement. That's what it sounds like.
Right. Yeah. If you bought a home with a basement, then that would be then part of the home. There's also talk about which structures on the house are part of the home. If you have a separate structure on the roof, is that part of the home or not? You know, again, a lot of details which we don't have time to go through. Okay. That brings us to source number four. If you have a field or a vineyard. Okay, unspecified without any additional details in the document. He acquires the height as well because they're not meant to be built upon. So in the absence of there being assumed to be a structure here, if I purchase a field, there's no specific height where you could say, oh, I assumed I'm selling you this much height on the land. If I'm buying a house, there's a specific height, assumed height to a house. Or if the house is there already, there's a height to the house. If I'm buying a field which is assumed to be used for agricultural purposes, then because there is no specific height, in the absence of any specifications, it will be assumed that I have purchased all the airspace, but you don't acquire the depth, because it's not because they are meant to dig into. Meaning, because the land has that separate use, going back to source one, of the ability to dig pits, I'm buying this piece of land to plant corn, or whatever I'm doing with it, you know, for farming purposes. So because there's a separate use that it could potentially be used for, to dig into, be it to drill for oil, be it to dig a cistern, be it to go digging for gold or coal or whatever, because it's a separate use, it is not assumed to be sold unless otherwise specified. And this kind of brings us into the case, what I would imagine are the majority of cases that take place. You're not... Avi, I assume you're not dealing with cases where you're buying the rights to oil rights under homes. But, you know, well, sometimes yes. Okay.
A lot of times.
Right? So I sit corrected then. But if you have a piece of land, the halacha does differ somewhat because it's meant for agricultural purposes. And so on a case-by-case basis, but again, even if you're buying it for farming, this fellow is buying it for farming, it's assumed that he is not buying the land, the mineral rights below. Okay, one question I do have, I don't have an answer to this, and you know, if you'd like to weigh in your opinions, is that I think that the case of oil or other items that are below the surface already kind of falls into a no man's land, no pun intended, and that is between the case of the cistern or the case of just the land rights, because in source number three. We mentioned two different uses. We mentioned the idea of the ability to dig and create a pit or a cistern. And we mentioned also there being pre-existing structures. And I mentioned that those are two different steps. If I just say, I'm selling you the home and the depth and the height, so you now, you the buyer, acquire the rights to dig into it or to build into the airspace, but you don't acquire the pre-existing structure like a pit or a cistern that's over there. You need additional terminology to convey that you're also buying the pre-existing structures that are there. So my question is, which category would pre-existing minerals or oil fall into? Is that called a pre-existing structure because it's there already? A pit doesn't exist yet. I just want the right to create a pit on the property. I don't have that right unless I specifically say I'm buying the land rights, then I buy the right to dig a hole on the property. That hole will fill up with water. Okay, but I'm really just buying the right to dig a hole. But would one then say that I'm also buying the rights to dig a hole and get the oil that I find in that hole? Or is the oil like a pit that's already dug on the property, you just have to access it? So I'm not sure which category it falls into. I'll just say my question again. If I bought the rights to the land, again, because we said it's split into two, land and air rights is one level, and then level two is I'm also buying the pre-existing structures. Anything which is already there on the land is a second level. Would minerals in the earth or oil or gas already in the earth, would that be considered buying just the land rights? Or do I need to specify I'm also buying whatever is already there on the land? I'm buying the cistern. I'm buying the pit. I have to specify that I'm buying the oil that may be in that property as well. Which category would that fall into? I'm not sure. I don't know. Okay, so that's a question. I'm not sure, you know, in terms of the halachic terminology, how far would you have to go in order to acquire the rights to the minerals and the other items in the land? I don't know. Okay? Are there anyone wants to venture an opinion over here before I move on? Did anyone get what I said? I won't confuse everyone. Okay. So, but that would be the question. So I'm not sure. So that's really as far as the question of what you acquire and what you don't. As far as the question, as Avi mentioned, of the ability to go onto the land and access it, so source number five talks about that as well. And source number five says, the seller must acquire a path from the buyer in order to access this pit or the cistern that he left behind. Okay, so even if the pit or the cistern is there already, and you retain that pit or cistern as the seller for yourself, you can't just walk into my property. You can't come, just walk in my backyard. Hi, I'm here to get the water. Or in modern terms, I'm here to drill for oil in your backyard. I have the right as the buyer to say, get off my property. You don't have the right to just walk onto my property. Again, if you wanted to do horizontal drilling and come from the outside and go underneath, that you would be allowed to do, assuming, going back, that there's no damage being done. But if you wanted to come onto my property, you would not have the right unless you purchased the rights to come onto the buyer's property. Okay, but if he wrote in the language of the sale, I sold you the house, and then he specified, except for the pit or the cistern, he needed to acquire a path for himself. Okay, and the reason for that is very simple. There's no need to say the words, I'm selling you the house except for the pit or the cistern. That's already built into the language. If I sell you a house, I'm not selling you the pit or the cistern. Why the need to specify, I'm not selling you the pit or the cistern? Again, that's excess verbiage, ostensibly. Those are extra words. So on this, the Shulchan Aruch is telling us the excess words are specifying, I'm keeping the pit and the cistern is indicative that I'm also retaining the right to walk in and use it. Okay? And again, we're coming back to this idea of you have to be very exacting in the terminologies and in the words used. If there are extra words in there, they're there for a reason. There's no need to say I'm retaining the cistern for myself. That's already built in by default. If you said it, you're giving over the idea that I'm retaining the right to go to it when I please. Okay, and therefore you wouldn't have to purchase the rights.
When it says a path, that specifically speaking about a path from a specific point A to a certain point B, or does it mean I can walk anywhere on the property as long as it's reasonable?
So I think it would be the shortest route, least invasive, route needed to get to it, is what you retain for yourself.
So it would have to be from the cistern on the south side, meaning from the south edge.
Right, assuming that that's easy access. Correct.
We would call that an easement, too, in property law. you know, one property has an easement to enter the other property. That happens all the time.
Yeah, they're called an easement of necessity.
Easement of necessity. Right. You would have that. Okay, so that kind of closes out the part of the discussion about the rights of the seller, the rights of the buyer. Now we come to the second question, the fracking question, if you will, the question of how much concern is there, what is my obligation as the oil driller, let's just say, in terms of causing damage to others. So there's a Mishnah in Tractate B'Lebasra that says, source number six, one may not dig a pit near his neighbor's pit unless he moves away from his neighbor's wall of the pit and applies lime. Okay? This is one of the most famous and difficult chapters in the Talmud to study. This is the opening salvo. This is the very first line of that chapter. It's the second chapter in Tractate Bava Basra. When I was studying in Lakewood, in the yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey, I spent about 2 months on about a page and a half of this section. It's very complex in all the details and so on. I'm just going to try to give over in a few minutes just a little bit of the idea. And this is the first line. And it gives over the idea that if you're digging a pit on your property, you have to take into consideration what the effects will be on others around you. And if you dig a pit on your property, if it's too close to an adjacent pit, it will cause damage to the walls, to the stability of that adjacent pit. And therefore, there's a specific distance that the pit digger needs to move away to ensure that it's not causing damage, and he has to put lime, what you might call cement in modern terms, around it in order to ensure that it not cause damage. Okay? There are a lot of cases discussed in the Talmud. The Tur, a work of Jewish law, says that everyone agrees that we can learn unspecified cases from specified cases. And all types of damage not specified in the Talmud, the amount of their distance is such that it does not cause damage. So if you're drilling for oil, or you're fracking, whatever it may be, again, I'm not getting involved in the details and whether it is or is not an issue, but let's just assume there is a potential problem. Yes, you're right, the Talmud didn't talk about drilling for oil. But we infer from the case that the Talmud does talk about that as drilling for oil, as digging for coal, whatever it may be, you have an obligation to ensure that you're not causing damage to any neighboring property, to others' rights, or to others' ownerships on that area. Okay? We're a little bit short on time, so I'm going to skip a little bit, and I just want to make one last point over here, which is in sources 9 and 10, and that is, what about in a case where you're not sure if there will be damage or not? And I think this may be a good case, again, without a great deal of information, but I am sure the argument can be made that it's not clear how much damage, if any damage, is caused by these kinds of drilling and so on and so forth. Upon whom is the burden of proof to prove that there's damage being done over here? Okay, so this is a very interesting question, because in Jewish law, in Talmudic law and halacha, there are two issues you have to deal with. One is monetary rights, and the general rule when it comes to monetary rights is that whoever is the one holding the property, the rights, the item, he is, as they say in English, ownership is nine tenths of the law. Possession is nine tenths of the law. If you want to take something away from me, you have to prove it. The burden of proof is on the one extracting it. Okay, and so because possession is nine tenths of the law, this holds true in other areas as well. If I want to dig a well, and you're coming screaming that it's gonna ruin your aquifer, and the water you're going to drink, it may be tainted or contaminated or whatnot, you are essentially taking away from me the right that I have right now to drill a well by dint of the fact that you may be damaged. And that being the case, I really don't have to be concerned with that unless you have proof that that is true. Because you're taking my rights away from me. I own this land. I want to go ahead and drill this oil well and so on and so forth. If you want to take that right away from me because of damage, you have to prove it. But there's another issue. And that is, we have an idea in Jewish law that when it comes to a prohibition, generally you have to err on the side of caution. So if I come across a piece of meat, and I don't know if it's kosher or non-kosher, I can't say, I'm not sure, I'm never going to find out, I can assume it's kosher. You can't assume it's kosher. You have to err on the side of caution. And here we get into a very interesting question. Are damages strictly monetary, or is causing damage to another an area of prohibition as well? And that's a question where there's a great deal of debate, and really boils down to that. Because if my neighbor is going to come and say, you may well be tainting my water, if it's strictly a monetary discussion, then I don't necessarily have to abstain from exercising my rights unless you can prove it. You want to take away my right, you have to prove it. But if you come and say, I spoke to the rabbi, and the rabbi said it's prohibited for you to cause damage to me, it's a prohibition, then I may have to err on the side of caution and abstain from drilling. And that is, in fact, a dispute between different halachic authorities. And like I said, if the case comes up and you wanted to go to a Jewish court of law, they would probably have to decide which way they would rule, among other factors, in deciding that question where there's a doubt of whether it will cause damage or not.
And that opens a whole conversation, you know, when you do business and where you know, monetary laws, like you got to prove that I owe you, we can fight it out. But it's a question of hurting somebody. It's not only about money, it's hurting somebody. So then...
Yeah, it does, it gets... It opens up a whole separate discussion, and it is, it's a complex discussion. It is a complex discussion, yeah.
Question about a case of doubt. I mean, obviously, the oil companies, everybody has that responsibility not to damage other people, but unfortunately, there is a hysteria in the media and among certain circles that certain people, if they would say, well, let me just look objectively, let me do research into fracking, instead, I think there's a lot of pressure in certain circles to feel that fracking, that's a terrible thing. How could you even think that they would use other oil companies to do fracking? So it's not, in other words, it's not a question of necessarily, like with the Talmud, analyzing where there could be damage or where there couldn't be damage in a very objective way. Unfortunately, when it gets into this hysteria thing, that this word of fracking, that's a terrible thing automatically. What do you mean I have to look into it? I don't have to look into it. Everybody knows it's a terrible thing. You know, right. Like so that thing is it's a dangerous thing. Actually, everybody knows that certain economies are being hurt because of in certain areas, rather than allowing a certain amount of drilling, which would benefit not only some of the landowners that have leases, but the state itself and income from whatever it is. Instead, there is so much pressure just to not to allow the fracking, irregardless of all the financial damage, not necessarily because it's a real issue, but rather because of the hysteria that's created along, you know, about this.
Just from a, you know, from the halachic standpoint, I would imagine you have to have some form of solid evidence that there's cause for concern. You know, you can't just walk in and say, we don't know what this well will do to, you know, the yellow-bellied sapsucker on the property, and it may cause ecological... I don't know that you could walk in with that claim. I would imagine you would have to have solid evidence, at least for the concern of the damage, you know, as opposed to what you just say, the knee-jerk reaction of, oh, this is going to be bad, type of thing.
Well, it kind of raises my head question.
Never.
If you keep coming to these classes, you'll find out.
Not so far, not. You know,
right.
We've covered just. I mean, have we done space travel yet, or mining on asteroids? Maybe we'll have to reach for space next.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just throw you one question about space travel. Well, when do you keep Shabbos every seventh day over there up in space? That's a question that's been dealt with. It's been dealt with already. They had, you know, the Israeli astronaut, you know.
Which way is east?
Went up. He unfortunately died on the way back in. Yeah, which way is east?
What if you go to Jupiter and
okay,
you fly...
Okay, thank you.
Is that it? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Oh, yeah.